Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 13. Eighth hole, again. With a precision stroke, Andrew chipped his ball onto the eighth green and watched it land with a satisfying thud 10 feet from the hole, precisely in the area he had planned. From there, he had a decent uphill putt with little, if any, break. Of the other two golfers with him, Frederick Martin had landed in a far sand trap. Carrie Newman landed on the green 25 feet from the hole, far from making a birdie. Martin hit a nice shot out of the sand, but the ball rolled past the pin until it stopped 15 feet on the other side of the hole. The green sloped down to the water hazard, and it was the best he could do from that position. Newman analyzed his lie and approached the ball with confidence. However, it was apparent to Andrew that the golfer was aiming too far to the left. Couldn't the idiot read a simple green? It wasn't that difficult. If it sloped to the left, you aim to the right. He watched as the man clubbed the ball and, as predicted, it rolled a foot left of the hole, then continued until it stopped 4 feet from the cup. Frederick Martin seemed to have a good read on his putt, but apparently was afraid to hit the ball hard enough, perhaps because his last shot had rolled too much. Now he was hitting uphill. Anything short of a confident putt would leave him still far from the hole. Martin hit the ball, and as Andrew foresaw, it lost steam and stopped a good 6 feet from the hole. Martin angrily smacked his putter head on the green, leaving a dent that his caddy quickly repaired. Andrew snorted at the burst of anger the man had shown. Even when his putt on 7 rimmed the hole, he knew that getting emotional wouldn't help the ball get in. It was his turn to putt. He laid down his ball and picked up his golden dollar that he used for a marker. It was large, but the rule said nothing about what size a ball marker could be, and did say a coin was acceptable. It glinted in the sun. Before every tournament, he would go to the bank and get a roll of the dollar coins, crack it open, and find the shiniest and least scratched one available. He squatted to re-examine the lie. If anything, he wanted the ball to end up on the right. To the left would leave him a downhill putt, and he avoided those at all costs, even at the price of missing a birdie. He took 2 practice swings to set the speed of his stroke and then stepped up. With robotic accuracy, he putted the ball. It headed straight for the hole, but broke slightly to the right, leaving a 6-inch tap-in for par, exactly the score he had planned for this hole. He carefully lined up the short putt and tapped it in. Polite applause ringed the green, and he pulled out his ball, handing it and his putter to Eric. Eric knew better than to say anything like, "Good par," or "Nice hole." Andrew Patterson already knew he had a good par or nice hole, and hated being told so by people who presumed to know better. Eric slid the putter carefully into its felt case, then slid the club gently into Patterson's bag. He placed the ball into the sleeve along the side of the golf bag. He had once placed a ball in his pocket, and Patterson had demanded it from him and threw it into the trees. Apparently, he didn't like to think of his balls mingling with whatever Eric had in his pocket, or perhaps being damaged by Eric's divot repair tool or car keys. Martin lined up his next putt, and once again it was short, but this time only by inches. He knocked the ball in carelessly and picked it up, striding quickly from the green, having bogeyed the hole after parring 7. Newman had the downhill lie that Andrew deftly avoided. As he practiced his putt, Andrew, standing across the green, noted the speed of his swing and quietly shook his head. Gary Newman's putt sent the ball speeding from the club face, and it actually bumped right over the hole. That was why Andrew never left a downhill lie. Even if you hit the ball straight on, the extra speed it gained could still deny you the hole. Newman lined up his next 2-foot putt and managed to get that one in. Andrew smiled. He was back to having honors, a position he enjoyed. He knew his drives could make even confident golfers a little nervous. He wanted these guys to see him nail the next one. Neither of them had a chance of taking the tournament from him, and they would know he was the best. He glanced at the scores of the tournament leaders. Hanover remained stubbornly at 7-under. Maybe he had been pulled from the tournament. He decided to find out and approached the boy holding the leaderboard. "Why haven't you updated Hanover's score?" he asked.
"He's not been playing."
"Was he disqualified?"
"Disqualified? No, sir, they're putting him in the last group."
"In this group?"
"I guess," answered the boy.
"What, he's just sitting around, waiting?"
"I suppose."
Well, it explained why his score hadn't been creeping up. They were going to put Hanover in with Andrew, presumably to build a little suspense into the tournament. The more Andrew thought about it, the more he liked the idea. There was nothing better to put the fear of God into someone than to have him golf with God. At least it would seem like that for Hanover. He walked to a red-jacketed official. "Is it true that there will be an addition to this threesome?" he asked.
"Addition? No. Top 2 guys after 9 go head-to-head, televised and everything."
"Televised?" The red-jacketed man pointed to the man carrying the television camera with the USA Sports logo that Andrew had long ago let slip out of his awareness. The red-jacketed man glanced at the leaderboard.
"Looks like it'll be you and Scott Hanover," he commented.
"Looks like," agreed Andrew. There was a crowd watching the golfers teeing off at the 10th hole. As Scott and Paul headed back to the clubhouse, one of the onlookers happened to glance in their direction and gave a double take. He seemed confused why someone was walking away from the 18th hole so early, but quickly returned his attention to the golfers heading out on the back 9. The 2 friends passed the rows of parked golf carts and neatly lined up hand carts that were used in an ordinary golfing day. Today they sat unused.
"Ready?" asked Paul.
"Ready as I'll ever be, I guess," answered Scott. They were amazed at how many people were now crowding around the clubhouse area, many watching the scoreboard as it was updated. Others gathered around the 9th green, applauding the golfers like it was a major tournament. Small groups were wandering around the edge of the 10th fairway, making their way to more distant holes to watch the game play out. Suddenly, the man who had seen them earlier from the 10th tee turned around. He confirmed the suspicion that had been growing in his head.
"It's him, from TV! It's Hanover!" he shouted.
Dozens of heads turned and looked to where the man pointed at Paul and Scott. A sea of people closed in on them. Most wanted to shake Scott's hand. Others wanted autographs. It was unreal, to say the least. After a few minutes, 4 red-jacketed men started pushing aside the curious onlookers and escorted Scott and Paul through the throng. As they reached the clubhouse, Jake Fisher managed to get near Scott.
"Where have you been?" he asked. "Everyone's looking for you."
"Apparently," Paul said.
Just checking out a few of the last holes, staying loose, he answered. They had walked around the near side of the pond that formed a boundary for not only the 18th hole, but the 17th as well, and checked out the pin placement on the 16th green. The quiet they had just left was in stark contrast to the mayhem they found themselves in now.
I was afraid you'd miss your tee off, Jake said. You weren't thinking of taking off, were you?
No, said Scott. Just killing time. A woman next to Jake coughed and pulled on Fisher's arm.
Oh, excuse me, started Jake. I'd like you to meet my friend, Gina Beck. She's a huge golf fan, he teased.
Actually, I do follow golf a little, enough to be very impressed with your accomplishment this morning, she said. She held out her hand and Scott shook it. Nice to meet you, Miss Beck. Gina, she corrected.
Mr. Hanover?
It was Bateman, the tournament official.
Everything checked out, so far that is.
There's a problem? Asked Paul.
Probably not. We'll let you know. It looks like you'll be in the last group. You're still 3 strokes ahead of the next closest player.
Wonderful, Scott said with all the enthusiasm he could muster. Nervousness flooded him, and he tried to remember what Ted had talked about earlier. He was here to play golf, not get sidetracked by all the excitement or agendas of anyone else. Play golf.
Mr. Hanover, shouted a woman.
Scott caught sight of a redhead bobbing a short distance away in the crowd. It's okay, he instructed his guards. Ellie worked her way up.
Just a quick question, she said. If you could have anything you wanted right now, what would it be?
Are you taping this? Asked Scott.
No, just curious, she said. Scott thought for a moment, but before he could answer, Paul did so for him.
A beer, he said.
Laughter rippled through the crowd. A beer? Questioned a voice from behind Ellie.
A beer?
Ellie stood aside, grinning as Sarah appeared before them.
You're here, Scott said. I'm here. How? Why?
He muttered, shaking his head. Will I do instead of the beer? She asked. Scott laughed and kissed her and hugged her as tightly as her distended belly would allow. A few camera clicks could be heard from the crowd.
I saw you on TV, Sarah explained, at the rummage sale. Sally here gave me a ride.
She indicated a blonde woman dressed casually standing next to her. Sally extended her hand.
I'm Sally Bernard. I believe you've already met my husband, Jason.
Scott's look of astonishment increased Sally's smile.
Small world, isn't it? She said.
Very small, Scott agreed. His arm was draped over Sarah's shoulders, and his escorts opened the clubhouse doors. The crowd inside was asked to leave the small dining area. Scott pulled out a chair for Sarah, and the 7 of them sat around a large round table.
Who's this?
Asked Sarah, noticing Jake and Gina, the only people she hadn't met already.
Oh, this is Jake Fisher, a sports agent, and his friend Gina Beck.
Sarah's eyes widened.
An agent? She asked.
Her surprise turned to suspicion. He does know you're done with golf for a while after this, right?
I've mentioned it, but he insisted he still wanted my soul. Either that or our firstborn, and I had to toss a coin.
She punched his arm hard.
Good thing I wasn't on the table. We'll have to talk about this later, she said.
Busted, commented Paul.
Shut up, said Scott,
and passed the arm punch to his caddy. Paul turned and punched Jake. Jake just rubbed his arm, a little confused.
They're just kids, pointed out Sarah. They're like that all the time, she explained. She turned her attention back to Scott. Ann and I just happened to pass some televisions at the rummage sale, and they mentioned something about the duck. And there you were, talking to a reporter.
Did Anna come? Scott asked. What do you think? Asked Sarah.
Right. But you're here. You came.
She grabbed his shoulder.
I'm sorry I missed the hole-in-one, Scott,
she said, tearing up.
We've got it on tape, Scott assured her, but he knew what she meant. He remembered he had been thinking about her when the ball went in. It wasn't easy getting here. You've created a small sensation. Everyone is talking about the guy who shot a 29. Even the cop on 159th Street knew about you.
Cop?
We were stuck in traffic, and he got us right in. There must be hundreds of cars trying to get into this place.
Wow.
Oh, by the way, I put the crib together, she mentioned, leaving out the fact that she had to do it twice.
He didn't need to know that.
Scott showed the appropriate look of surprise and awe.
You what?
Yep, you're not the only one with hidden talents.
The girl from the snack bar brought a tray of drinks with a couple of baskets of nacho chips, dripping with cheese.
On the house, she announced.
Thanks, Cassie, said Scott,
and they all dug in. Sarah cast a wary eye in Scott's direction.
Cassie? She asked.
I gave her an autograph earlier, he explained.
Wow, a lot has happened since this morning, she stated.
As she reached for a tortilla chip, she felt a contraction come on and stopped herself to concentrate on her breathing.
Are you okay? Asked Scott.
His jovial mood had flashed into concern at the apparent agony on his wife's face.
Just a little practice contraction, she stammered. She took a few more breaths. I've been having them all day. Anna says it's probably false labor.
What did the doctor say?
Well, I haven't called him yet. I figured if they were still happening after the tournament, I'd check and see if I needed to do anything.
Scott eyed her suspiciously.
You're sure it's not the baby coming?
Honey, if I was in labor, I wouldn't be sitting here, and neither would you.
She placed her hand on his.
Don't worry about it. I'm fine.
You go have fun.
Scott kissed her and looked in her eyes. Everything seemed fine. Besides, the kid wasn't due for 2 more weeks.
By the way, started Ellie between bites of cheese-covered chips, they're going to use 3 camera crews to cover you and Patterson. That won't make you nervous, will it?
Not as nervous as a crowd of onlookers. They better keep them back, Scott warned.
Way back, added Paul. They all laughed.
Paul stood up. I'm going to track down your clubs. I'll meet you at the 10th tee.
I'll be there, Scott assured him.
We'll all be there, added Sarah.
Wouldn't miss it, Sally said.
Scott was still 3 strokes ahead.
There was a chance that Andrew would lose. She liked these people and really wanted Scott and Sarah to have this day end up with a win. But she knew that from this point on, everything was icing on the cake for them, win or lose.
She tried not to let her gaze linger too long on Sarah's belly. She wanted some cake, too. The crowds had moved on. The 2 men in the cart rode along the right side of the 8th fairway until they had reached the area that Kenny Chase had marked on the map. Somewhere in the cold, dark, mucky water was a ball that Chase wanted. There were likely hundreds, if not thousands, of balls in that water. It had been nearly 3 months since the Ball Retrieval Company had swept the hazards to reclaim and recycle the errant shots of the everyday golfers. Few had landed in the water today, but that few included Scott Hanover. The ball he was looking for was supposed to have a yellow duck imprinted on it.
Like a rubber ducky, Chase had said.
This is the spot, said the driver. Looks like fun.
The man in the wetsuit hopped out and swung the tarp off the equipment in the wagon behind the cart. He set up the tank on the edge of the wagon, turned the valve, and checked the pressure gauge. He slipped his arms into the vest and grabbed his mask and snorkel, slipping the mask snugly over his face and placing the mouthpiece from the tank into his mouth. He sucked a dry mouthful of the canned air to check that the gas was flowing properly. He wouldn't need fins. They would just stir up the mud anyway. The water was only 3 or 4 feet deep. The weight of the tank would be enough to keep him near the bottom.
The diver walked to the edge of the water and sat on the grass, then dangled his feet in. If he reached with his toes, he could touch the soft bottom.
It was strange that as a kid he waded through far more disgusting waters than these, and had delighted in salting any leeches that had attached themselves to him during his explorations. Years of diving in the warm, clear waters of the Caribbean Sea had spoiled him.
The best case, he figured, was that he'd spend 20 or 30 minutes looking and report back to Chase that the ball was unfindable unless they dragged the whole pond and sorted out the contents. If it weren't for the $100 Chase had slipped him, he wouldn't be doing it at all. The diver slid off the bank and shivered as a thin layer of water flowed under the suit next to his skin. It would take a few minutes to warm up, but then it would provide a layer of insulation. But that first shock was a killer. A dry suit might be more appropriate for the conditions, but he'd make do. He bit down on the mouthpiece and lowered his face into the water. The part of his face not covered by rubber was almost instantly numbed. The water was murky, and he could see maybe 3 feet. As he sank into the pond, the bottom became clearer, and white and gray domes sticking up from the silt appeared. This was going to be impossible. He tried picking up a ball, but the silt he stirred up obscured his view of the balls for a 1 foot radius. He waited for the debris to settle, then, using his fingertips, slowly moved over the bottom, sweeping his eyes from side to side, looking for the yellow duck design that had been described to him. He went out perhaps 3 yards, then turned to his right. He would sweep another 10-yard by 3-yard box. If he didn't find it, he'd start picking up all the balls he could collect and sort through them on the bank. Maybe he'd get lucky. Another 3 yards of slow progress and he was back at the edge of the pond. Carefully, he turned left. His previous path had left a wake of cloudy water, despite his careful movements, under which nothing was visible. He turned his head from side to side, scanning as much of an area as possible before swimming back out. A glint of yellow caught his eye. He slowly brought his right hand to the area and picked up the ball. A cloud of silt came up with it, obscuring it. He brought it closer to his mask, and once it was 6 inches away, a smiling yellow duck looked at him through the glass. This was it. He stood up and let the water drip off his back. All around him, mud was stirring, and if this wasn't the ball, they wouldn't find it today without dragging the entire bottom. He let the regulator fall out of his mouth, and he pushed up his mask. He looked at the ball in his right hand again and smiled.
"You got it?"
asked the driver. He had been sure this was a wild duck chase.
"Got it," answered the diver.
"Gotta be a miracle."
The diver tossed the ball to the driver and started to climb up. As he got out onto the bank, he noticed the crowd disappearing over the hill that hid the ninth tee. Everyone except a cameraman who had his lens trained on the two. He waved and smiled. The cameraman waved back, let his camera drop, and turned to follow the rest of the tournament people.
"Hey, I'm going to be on TV," said the diver.
"Congratulations," said the driver. "Let's go."
"Yeah, I want to get dry and fast."
"Coffee's on me."
"You bet it is."
Karen fumbled 4 quarters out of her purse. The payphone required 2 for the first 2 minutes. Any more calls than this and she'd have to get more change or call collect. It had taken her 5 minutes to even get to the payphone through the hordes of people, threading their way through each other around the clubhouse. She dialed April Weinstein's extension. It rang 4, then 5 times.
"Come on," muttered Karen. "Pick up already."
After the 6th ring, a familiar voice said,
"Hello."
It was familiar, but not April's voice. It was Jonathan Jones's.
"Where's April?" she asked.
"Karen, is that you?"
asked Jones. "You know it's me, Jonathan. I need to talk to April. I'm on a payphone, and I can't waste time chatting."
"I think she went to the restroom,"
he answered, delighting in her situation.
"Cell phone dead?"
he asked. Karen didn't answer him, but scrunched up her face as she recalled her wild goose chase earlier this morning.
"Had a little fun with April and me today, haven't you, Jonathan?"
"How's that?"
Jonathan asked, enjoying the position he had over her.
"You knew I couldn't resist trying to get the kid signed up, too." "Well, your plan didn't work. I got to Patterson first.
I don't know about this Hanover fellow, but Calloway wants Patterson, and I've got Patterson.
Calloway is going to want a winner,
answered Jonathan. A distant voice cut in over the line.
What are you doing in here?
Asked April Weinstein.
Heard the phone ringing,
answered Jonathan, his voice muted by his hand over the mouthpiece.
Give that to me,
insisted April, drawing closer.
Karen?
She asked.
Please deposit 50 cents for the next 2 minutes,
interrupted the automated recording. Shoot, muttered Karen, as she dropped one of the quarters. She popped in the first one.
Please deposit 25 cents,
urged the voice again. I'm trying, answered Karen. The quarter had rolled under a bush. She got on her knees and reached into the brush to get the coin. She smiled as she pulled it out and stood up staring at the quarter. She bumped the back of her head on the shelf inside the booth, and it almost knocked her on the ground. Her exclamation was a little more serious this time. She picked up the handset and slipped the second quarter into the slot. 5 quick beeps signaled the phone had successfully consumed the coin and granted her credit for 2 more minutes.
Are you all right?
April asked her. Fine. Listen, April. I need a new phone, but more importantly, we need to get someone from Calloway here. With this thing being televised, it will be a great time for them to announce their newest spokesman, Andrew Patterson, on USA Sports Network.
That sounds like a good idea. I'll see if Tim Carousel is in town. In any case, I'm coming down there, too. You have 30 seconds,
interrupted the voice. You better get yourself a helicopter, unless things have changed dramatically. The roads are a mess. Heck, I'm a mess.
Hold it together, Karen.
I am holding it together. And bring me some sneakers. These shoes are killing me, she added.
I'll try.
Just do it, she added.
Please deposit 50 cents for the next 2 minutes,
requested the operator's recording. Karen slammed the handset onto the payphone and leaned against the wall, exasperated. What a day this was turning out to be. Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series. Cozy mysteries about a crime-solving veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.